they say, okay, fine, the oil market's doing well, these companies are generating good cash flow, but it's because the market's acting irrationally. I don't know that I want to align myself with that irrational behavior because it's subject to change at any time. I would rather go into an industry where the fundamentals are more transparent and more controllable. And again, I don't know that that doesn't mean that the tanker market won't work. I think it probably will. It's at valuations that appear to be pretty obvious. But that is a fundamental challenge for investors. A company can come out and say, look, isn't this great all day long? But at the end of the day, they have no control over whether or not it stays that way. And it probably will. But it may not, and that's enough to spook an awful lot of investors that I talk to on a daily basis. I think within the equity universe, where you can get investors more on board is in situations where there's a catalyst or a potential catalyst. Take, for example, a company like Golar and their FLNG, and there's a lot of doubters, and that stock has been pretty poor. But the fact is, just 2 weeks ago, when Schlumberger said that they were going to participate with Golar, the share price was up 50%. It's a catalyst, and there's not really a catalyst in the crude market until the energy market starts to settle and people can get a little bit more comfortable that hey, this price is irrational. Catalysts are probably the only avenue to outperformance, in my opinion.
I would like to comment on that. I think the major problem that we have today is that capital is way too short term. It's the shipping industry, which is cyclical, if you try to make a positive return absolutely every day, it's just a matter of time before you lose your money. And I think personally, I favor I definitely like Golar, and you're well aware of that. But I think the problem today is capital being way too short term. And I'm not sure if the short term capital is, if shipping is the right place for short term capital.
I think that's the problem. Everybody that's interested in investing in shipping outside of the people in this room are short-term investors. By and large, at the moment, with just a few exceptions, they're all hedge funds. And by definition, almost all hedge funds are short-term capital. So if you can't convince them that they can make a return in the short term, then they're not going to do it. And the guys that do have long-term capital, they're the ones that are concerned that the companies they're investing in can't control their own destiny, unless they have a fantastic balance sheet or what have you. And I think at the moment, that's the most important thing a company can do, is solidify their balance sheet, because when things do get rational, they're going to be in the best position to come out of it. But it's the nature of the beast. Certainly in this environment, there's just long-term capital is not interested. It is what it is outside of private equity, which the guys talked about earlier. But I think in terms of incremental equity investments and frankly even debt investments, this market today is focused on the near term, and like it or not, that's the reality.
Maybe stepping away from tankers and talking a little bit about containers. We haven't spoke that much today. Probably next to dry bulk, they've been hit pretty hard with the slowdown in world trade, difficulties in China. What are your thoughts in the sector? Are there opportunities? Is there a role for consolidation in the container sector? Robert, you want to?
When I look at the container sector, I actually been joking that it's probably quietly as bad, if not worse, than dry bulk. The owners the liner operators continually order bigger ships, larger ships. It's massively oversupplied. You know, there was cascading to an extent, but now basically anything below 11,000 TEU is earning less than 10,000 a day. And a lot of these ships are extremely expensive. They were extremely expensively built. And, these guys are starting to lose money several years in a row. I mean, I remember when we were doing box ships, I think there was only one year that a liner operator lost money, and that was 2009. Now it's several years in a row. I mean, some of them maybe they've broken even in one of these years, maybe they've made a little bit of money, but everyone's hurting in container shipping. And I start to get worried that the liner operators at some point, I mean, you see it now with HMM, they're going around, they're trying to cut the charters on, granted their entire book. and you're going to see, you might start seeing some other liner operators that start running into issues as well. I mean, people talk about the fact that it's never happened in containers. People don't really cut rates in containers, but it does happen. There's some renegotiation. Maybe it's not just a cut. Maybe they don't stop paying you. But, you know, it becomes an issue. And I think it's going to stay that way for a while. I mean, you see it now. It's just, you know, if you look at the industry, I think it's just massively oversupplied. These bigger vessels, you know, people forget when you order 18,000 TEU vessels, they're not profitable if they're not, you know, 75%, 80% utilized with containers. And, you know, that's where we are now, that these ships are just trying to maintain, you know, some sort of capacity and to make some sort of money. Talking about the fact consolidation, I mean, you see the liner operators now consolidating. I mean, I'll let you guys touch on that a little bit more, but I mean, you see it. People are trying to consolidate, at least at the liner level, trying to rationalize the routes and things like that now. So they're trying, but they're still losing a lot of money. I mean, hell, it's like, what less than $600 to ship a container from China to Europe now, something like this? I mean, it's crazy.
Well, if you go on the demand side on containers, what you've seen historically, the rule of thumb has been volume growth is 2x GDP growth, and then it fell to 1.4x in 2014 and 0.9x last year. I think eventually and as you point out, the operators are focusing on cutting costs, and that's, you know, from an owner perspective, that's not a good position to be in, particularly not when the guy on the other side of the table is as big and strong as they are. But I think, at least what we view is that from an investment perspective, the best way to play the container industry is actually Maersk, who's a fantastic company and the leader in the space, a cost leader. And that's kind of how we focus on container at the moment.
I have two things. First of all, with respect to the demand side and trade, I heard an interview the other day with, I think it was the chief strategy officer of IKEA, the big furniture company, and he said that globally, well, within the United States and Europe in particular, we've reached what he called peak stuff, where, like peak oil, you've reached a plateau where people just don't need any more stuff anymore. And I think that, to Herman's point, I think that's why we've begun to see this decoupling from GDP to container volumes, because containers are stuff, or they're filled with stuff. And in the developing markets, people just aren't buying more stuff. Where that becomes a big challenge is where, in the past number of years, where we have seen growth is in a lot of the emerging economies. You've seen a healthy north-south trade from the Far East to Latin America, Africa, or some of these places. The big issue there is what happens when those economies turn south. I mean, look at what's happening in the Brazilian economy, and effectively all of those developing economies are resource-based economies where they have oil or iron ore or some other commodity which, by and large, has just been decimated. Your final growth driver for the container space in these emerging markets is all of a sudden turned off at the same time we've reached this peak stuff environment. And I think that the days of consistent 5-8% container shipping demand are gone. That is a thing of the past. It's still will ultimately be a cyclical business. And the other aspect, I think, from a lessor perspective, that I think is interesting is a lot of the lessors have really benefited from an unsustainably low cost of capital, where you can go out and buy a ship and, you know, get what seems to be a rate of return that once you lever it with a virtually zero cost of debt, you can make an exceptional rate of return. Well, what happens when banks aren't so eager to be making loans, and all of a sudden their interest rate margins start to go up a little bit, it becomes a lot more challenging to get the capital in the first place, but ultimately continue to make a rate of return that is both acceptable to the owner as well as acceptable to the liner company.
Just a comment on that as well. I think I have a lot of stuff that I still want. I think, you know, if you look at the demand side of the container market, one of the issues I've been having is European slow growth in Europe. And on a TU mile basis, Europe is obviously though not as important in volume, it's extremely important in TU miles. So in a way, we think that the kind of the real upside on the container market will be found first when you see a meaningful recovery in Europe, because I do know that there are a lot of people in Europe who still want lots of stuff if they can afford it.
Herman, maybe if you could just sort of take us through LPG, LNG opportunities in there. It's something that we haven't spent too much time on today.
Sure. On the LPG side, I think it's a challenging outlook on the supply side, which I think everyone knows. What really worries me as well is the growth in U.S. propane production has started to slow down. So we're fundamentally not that bullish on the LPG space, though stocks are cheap. On the LNG side, I think, at least personally, and I even bought Golar on my PA account, which wasn't a very good idea. But if Golar is able to do what they are trying to do, which effectively is to completely redefine the way the LNG structure works today. They teamed up, as Ben alluded to, with Schlumberger, and they're effectively trying to create the full value chain from the upstream part and straight into the electricity grid or into a power plant. The problem with the LNG market today is A, cost of liquefaction cost is too high, and B, there's too many intermediaries. The first time I talked to a guy called Oscar Spiegler in Golar, he said LNG stands for long negotiating game. It takes forever to execute projects. And that's what Golar is trying to do with Schlumberger. And if they're successful in doing that by, with Schlumberger, accessing very cheap upstream gas, they will effectively have a delivered electricity price into the global electricity market of $4.1 to $4.3 cent per kilowatt hours. And to put things in perspective, in Brazil, the wholesale price is about 9 cents per kilowatt hour. In Philippines, it's 18, which means effectively if the project captures that entire value creation, then you have 1.5 to 6 year repayment of the entire infrastructure. So it's Golar to me is a company with a vision and trying to change how the dynamics are, and frankly it's required. It's required to find a way to generate liquefaction growth, because as it is now, the Australian projects aren't competitive whatsoever. They're way too high on the cost curve. Even the low cost US projects are struggling. So Golar, I hope, is a part of a solution to the long-term prospects for the LNG market.
Ben, any thoughts on your end, any diamonds in the rough?
Yeah, I think as opposed to the tanker space, and again, I think the tanker space should do reasonably well, but I think when you look at the underlying fundamentals of the compare and contrasting, say, tankers to LNG or even LPG, what you have is a tanker space where you're largely dependent on OPEC to continue to really pump out oil in order for it to work, and if they don't, then oil prices come up. But if that were to happen, then obviously natural gas prices come up, more than likely LPG prices come up. And the reason, and ultimately, if the prices come up, you're going to get a big influx of new volume from those. So in some ways, it's inversely correlated to oil prices. And longer term, I think, because the resources are available, both in the United States and other places, your runway to growth in both LPG and LNG is much more transparent, is much more obvious, and ultimately there will be no shortage of opportunities in those areas that for the moment many investors are basically leaving for dead, because they're looking at $28 oil or whatever it is and saying, well, clearly this is never going to work. And the reality is, virtually everybody in this room can agree that we're probably not sustainably in a $30 oil price environment. And so I think you have a resource base that will eventually grow. And when it does, you'll need ships to move it. And I think what investors can longer term get behind is something where, again, there's a predictable level of demand growth. Like to Herman's point earlier, one of the things that investors like to see is predictability. That increases their confidence in their investment. And longer term, to the extent that you have resource bases that will grow, there's a higher degree of longer term predictability in those categories. And I personally think over a longer investment horizon, the LPG and LNG names have a much longer runway in terms of the upside in the equities relative to most of the other categories, which admittedly everything's cheap right now. So.
Let me just say what these guys all said was completely wrong. No, I'm kidding. But basically, I mean, just thinking about LNG, I mean, I'm not the biggest LNG guy. I don't cover the sector. But it seems like it's still in the young ages, as you guys said. I mean, you can actually see the path to growth. You can see how the shipping, how it's going to develop. It might be longer term. It reminds me sort of the tech sector, when I used to cover tech, where there's sort of the hype stage, and then everyone's excited, and then it sort of collapses, and everyone says, oh, this is horrible. And then eventually it actually does exactly what everyone thought it would do, just longer than it would take. And I think that's pretty much where we are for the LNG, LPG sector now. That's it.
So moving to dry bulk. So last year at this conference, I had posed a question to the panel that I had $100,000. I was prepared to be risky, and I wanted to double my money in the next 12 to 18 months. The panel basically sent me to dry bulk. Just want to report in, it didn't work out that well.
We didn't say what you were going to do. Did you hair the short, or was it?
No, it was a long, you were telling me. Dry bulk, is it time you suggesting I double down on this year again, or what do you think? Ben, why don't you take, be nice.
Okay, well, I think something has fundamentally changed in the dry bulk space since last year, and we as analysts probably should have predicted it, and unfortunately didn't. But when you look at what moves on dry bulk, 51% of all coal that is moved is imported into China. 54% of all aluminum that is moved is imported into China. 45% of all steel is produced in China. You can't be more levered to China than the dry bulk market is. So what happens when Chinese industrial growth, or GDP, goes from 7% to what I think is probably south of 4%? It's not pretty, and that doesn't even begin to touch the supply side. I think that's the issue. It's a levered China play, and China's just not working. Eventually, you know, we'll get to a more sustainable supply and demand balance. But given how there's a saying that used to go around that when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. Well, that's begun to happen in reverse. So when China sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. They're the 800-pound gorilla. Little moves in what's going on in China make big differences in the dry bulk space. Unfortunately, it's a lot more than a little move. It's a big move, and it's going down, and it's still going down. And you know, unfortunately, I don't have any clarity as to when that stops, which is not especially pleasant. So, yeah.
So Onassis once said that, except that the, the day of the quotes, but he once said that, except that the sea will never rest and learn to sail in the high winds. And I fully agree with Ben that the dry market looks very rough the next couple of years. But again, the way to make money is to buy low and sell high. People, I think, forget to remind themselves of why are things cheap. Right now, we are on a nominal 30-year low on asset prices for a very good reason, as Ben just pointed to. And I think, you know, if you look at dry bulk demand growth since 1975 or 1976, volume of trade has increased by 3.4%.
And then you can say, well, the last 15 years, China has been 70-80% of the demand growth in the dry market. So if you then look at the period from 75 to 2001, China became member of WTO in December 2001. If you look at volume trade up until that, it was still about 2.5 to 2.8%, whether you start in 75 or 76. 75 was a down period. So I think fundamentally, do you believe that there is a future for the dry market? When I ask myself that question, I say, yes, I do believe there is a future for the dry bulk market. When it will turn, I find that very challenging to you know, say it will happen tomorrow or December 2017. But I know that if you find if you can invest into the dry bulk space and sail the rough seas that we have in the next couple of years, most likely you're not going to do a very bad investment. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see a lot of the very intelligent and with a very long track record of ship owners investing into the dry bulk market. Should you buy any dry bulk equities? No way. I mean, that's playing Russian roulette. But yeah, I think you should go and buy yourself a ship. Don't take too much debt on it, and be patient.
Thank you.
I would argue don't take any debt if you can afford to buy a ship now. But, you know, if you look at it, as you said, I mean, the guys that are buying, for better or for worse, have deep pockets. So if this lasts 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, they'll be okay. It depends on what you want to do. I mean, now's the time that vessel values are insanely cheap. They could get cheaper. I mean, let's be fair. China's, you know, there's a lot of talk that China coal imports are only about 5 to 7% of the total demand for Chinese coal, let's say. But that could go to zero. I mean, it could. China, it's only about 200 million tons. They could easily, you know, environmental concerns, it could go to zero. So we have to see what's going to happen. I generally agree with Herman. I think we're back in the world where dry bulk grows at about 2 to 3% a year going forward, once China sorts itself out. But there's still a vast oversupply of vessels, and that needs to be fixed. You know, I've heard the guys earlier talking about scrapping and layups, and scrapping's better than layups, but I still argue that there's probably too much scrap steel in the world, and there's going to be more. Scrap prices are falling like crazy, so I don't understand why the scrap yards would expand to take more capacity. I just don't see it. So you're looking at 2 to 3 years at least, if you're talking scrapping, to get back to a more balanced market.
But just a follow-up as well. I think Ben said something very smart earlier on.
Impossible.
But I think it's the question you also have to ask yourself is dry bulk the right place to put your money now? Are you getting a better risk reward in other sectors? Should you be buying a ship? I find it amazing that that ship owners today go and buy a tanker in the second-hand market. When you can buy, for example, DHT, which is effectively pricing in $58 million for a five-year-old Cape, right. 26% lower asset prices. It's fully financed, all the vessels on the water. Why on earth do you go and buy a ship? Everything is taken care of for you. You just have to push the buy button and sit and wait, rather than doing all the paperwork with ship brokers, and I probably shouldn't say that being from a ship broker firm.
Careful.
But it do puzzles me that there are secondhand transactions when the stocks are so cheap from very healthy companies, and you do also have the liquidity to just sell the shares in one day if you want to, rather than having 15 guys inspect the vessel and so on.
Well, Herman, it's not nearly as cool to be in stock owner as it is to be a ship owner. So I think that has a lot to do with that.
Well, look, guys, this has been an excellent discussion. Thank you very much. We're up against time, but maybe we'll just see if there's a couple quick questions from the audience. This is it. I got a lot of good advice last year. This is your chance.
Maybe the question is, can we have a drink?
Nick, please.
Could I point out I wasn't here last year? I wasn't an analyst last year.
They say, okay, fine, the oil market's doing well. These companies are generating good cash flow, but it's because the market's acting irrationally. I don't know that I want to align myself with that irrational behavior because it's subject to change at any time. I would rather go into an industry where the fundamentals are more transparent and more controllable. And again, I don't know that that doesn't mean that the tanker market won't work. I think it probably will. It's at valuations that appear to be pretty obvious. But that is a fundamental challenge for investors. A company can come out and say, look, isn't this great all day long? But at the end of the day, they have no control over whether or not it stays that way. And it probably will. But it may not, and that's enough to spook an awful lot of investors that I talk to on a daily basis. I think within the equity universe, where you can get investors more on board is in situations where there's a catalyst or a potential catalyst. Take, for example, a company like Golar and their FLNG, and there's a lot of doubters, and that stock has been pretty poor. But the fact is, just 2 weeks ago, when Schlumberger said that they were going to participate with Golar, the share price was up 50%. It's a catalyst, and there's not really a catalyst in the crude market until the energy market starts to settle and people can get a little bit more comfortable that hey, this price is irrational. Catalysts are probably the only avenue to outperformance, in my opinion.
I would like to comment on that. I think the major problem that we have today is that capital is way too short term. It's the shipping industry, which is cyclical, if you try to make a positive return absolutely every day, it's just a matter of time before you lose your money. And I think personally, I favor the, I mean, I definitely like Golar, and you're well aware of that, but I think the problem today is capital being way too short term. And I'm not sure if the short term capital is, if shipping is the right place for short term capital.
I think that's the problem. Everybody that's interested in investing in shipping outside of the people in this room are short-term investors. By and large, at the moment, with just a few exceptions, they're all hedge funds. And by definition, almost all hedge funds are short-term capital. So if you can't convince them that they can make a return in the short term, then they're not going to do it. And the guys that do have long-term capital, they're the ones that are concerned that the companies they're investing in can't control their own destiny, unless they have a fantastic balance sheet or what have you. And I think at the moment, that's the most important thing a company can do, is solidify their balance sheet, because when things do get rational, they're going to be in the best position to come out of it. But it's the nature of the beast. Certainly in this environment, there's just long-term capital is not interested. It is what it is outside of private equity, which the guys talked about earlier. But I think in terms of incremental equity investments and frankly even debt investments, this market today is focused on the near term, and like it or not, that's the reality.
Maybe stepping away from tankers and talking a little bit about containers. We haven't spoke that much today. Probably next to dry bulk, they've been hit pretty hard with the slowdown in world trade, difficulties in China. What are your thoughts in this sector? Are there opportunities? Is there a role for consolidation in the container sector? Robert, you want
to? When I look at the container sector, I actually been joking that it's probably quietly as bad, if not worse, than dry bulk. The owners the liner operators continually order bigger ships, larger ships. It's massively oversupplied. You know, there was cascading to an extent, but now basically anything below 11,000 TEU is earning less than 10,000 a day. And a lot of these ships are extremely expensive. They were extremely expensively built. And, you know, these guys are starting to lose money several years in a row. I mean, I remember when we were doing box ships, I think there was only one year that a liner operator lost money, and that was 2009. Now it's several years in a row. I mean, some of them maybe they've broken even in one of these years, maybe they've made a little bit of money, but everyone's hurting in container shipping. And I start to get worried that the liner operators at some point, I mean, you see it now with HMM, they're going around, they're trying to cut the charters on, you know, granted their entire book. And you might start seeing some other liner operators that start running into issues as well. I mean, people talk about the fact that it's never happened in containers. People don't really cut rates in containers, but it does happen. There's some renegotiation. Maybe it's not just a cut. Maybe they don't stop paying you. But, you know, it becomes an issue. And I think it's going to stay that way for a while. I mean, You see it now. It's just, you know, if you look at the industry, I think it's just massively oversupplied. These bigger vessels, you know, people forget when you order 18,000 TEU vessels, they're not profitable if they're not, you know, 75%, 80% utilized with containers. And, you know, that's where we are now, that these ships are just trying to maintain, you know, some sort of capacity and to make some sort of money. Talking about the fact consolidation, I mean, you see the liner operators now consolidating. I mean, I'll let you guys touch on that a little bit more, but I mean, you see it. People are trying to consolidate it, at least at the liner level, trying to rationalize the routes and things like that now. So they're trying, but they're still losing a lot of money. I mean, hell, it's like, what less than $600 to ship a container from China to Europe now, something like this? I mean, it's crazy.
Well, if you go on the demand side on containers, what you've seen historically, the rule of thumb has been volume growth is 2x GDP growth, and then it fell to 1.4x in 2014 and 0.9x last year. I think eventually and as you point out, the operators are focusing on cutting costs, and that's, you know, from an owner perspective, that's not a good position to be, particularly not when the guy on the other side of the table is as big and strong as they are. But I think, at least what we view is that from an investment perspective, the best way to play the container industry is actually Maersk, who's a fantastic company and the leader in the space, a cost leader. And that's kind of how we focus on container at the moment.
I have two things. First of all, with respect to the demand side and trade, I heard an interview the other day with, I think it was the chief strategy officer of IKEA, the big furniture company. And he said that globally, well, within the United States and Europe in particular, we've reached what he called peak stuff, where, like peak oil, you've reached a plateau where people just don't need any more stuff anymore. And I think that, to Herman's point, I think that's why we've begun to see this decoupling from GDP to container volumes, because containers are stuff, or they're filled with stuff. And in the developing markets, people just aren't buying more stuff. Where that becomes a big challenge is where in the past number of years where we have seen growth is in a lot of the emerging economies. You've seen a healthy north-south trade from the Far East to Latin America, Africa, or some of these places. The big issue there is what happens when those economies turn south. I mean, look at what's happening in the Brazilian economy, and effectively all of those developing economies are resource-based economies where they have oil or iron ore or some other commodity which by and large has just been decimated. Your final growth driver for the container space in these emerging markets is all of a sudden turned off at the same time we've reached this peak stuff environment. And I think that the days of consistent 5-8% container shipping demand are gone. That is a thing of the past. That said, it's still will ultimately be a cyclical business. And the other aspect, I think, from a lessor perspective, that I think is interesting is a lot of the lessors have really benefited from an unsustainably low cost of capital, where you can go out and buy a ship and, you know, get what seems to be a rate of return that once you lever it with a virtually zero cost of debt, you can make an exceptional rate of return. Well, what happens when banks aren't so eager to be making loans, and all of a sudden their interest rate margins start to go up a little bit, it becomes a lot more challenging to get the capital in the first place, but ultimately continue to make a rate of return that is both acceptable to the owner as well as acceptable to the liner company.
Just a comment on that as well. I think I have a lot of stuff that I still want. I think, you know, if you look at the demand side of the container market, one of the issues I've been having is European slow growth in Europe. And on a TU mile basis, Europe is obviously, though not as important in volume, it's extremely important in TU miles. So in a way, we think that the kind of the real upside on the container market will be found first when you see a meaningful recovery in Europe, because I do know that there are a lot of people in Europe who still want lots of stuff, if they can afford it.
Herman, maybe if you could just sort of take us through LPG, LNG opportunities in there. It's something that we haven't spent too much time on today.
Sure. On the LPG side, I think it's a challenging outlook on the supply side, which I think everyone knows. What really worries me as well is the growth in U.S. propane production has started to slow down. So we're fundamentally not that bullish on the LPG space, though stocks are cheap. On the LNG side, I think at least personally, and I even bought Golar on my PA account, which wasn't a very good idea. But if Golar is able to do what they are trying to do, which effectively is to completely redefine the way the LNG structure works today. They teamed up, as Ben alluded to, with Schlumberger, and they're effectively trying to create the full value chain from the upstream part and straight into the electricity grid or into a power plant. The problem with the LNG market today is A, cost of liquefaction cost is too high, and B, there's too many intermediaries. The first time I talked to a guy called Oscar Spiegler in Golar, he said LNG stands for long negotiating game. It takes forever to execute projects. And that's what Golar is trying to do with Schlumberger. And if they're successful in doing that by, with Schlumberger, accessing very cheap upstream gas, they will effectively have a delivered electricity price into the global electricity market of $4.1 to $4.3 cent per kilowatt hours. And to put things in perspective, in Brazil, the wholesale price is about 9 cents per kilowatt hour. In Philippines, it's 18, which means effectively if the project captures that entire value creation, then you have 1.5 to 6 year repayment of the entire infrastructure. So it's Golar to me is a company with a vision and trying to change how the dynamics are, and frankly it's required. It's required to find a way to generate liquefaction growth, because as it is now, the Australian projects aren't competitive whatsoever. They're way too high on the cost curve. Even the low-cost US projects are struggling. So Golar, I hope, is a part of a solution to the long-term prospects for the LNG market.
Ben, any thoughts on your end, on the diamonds in the rough?
Yeah, I think as opposed to the tanker space, and again, I think the tanker space should do reasonably well. But I think when you look at the underlying fundamentals of the comparing and contrasting, say, tankers to LNG or even LPG, what you have is a tanker space where you're largely dependent on OPEC to continue to really pump out oil in order for it to work, and if they don't, then oil prices come up. But if that were to happen, then obviously natural gas prices come up, more than likely LPG prices come up. And the reason, and ultimately, if the prices come up, you're going to get a big influx of new volume from those. So in some ways, it's inversely correlated to oil prices. And longer term, I think, because the resources are available, both in the United States and other places, there your runway to growth in both LPG and LNG is much more transparent, is much more obvious, and ultimately there will be no shortage of opportunities in those areas that, for the moment, many investors are basically leaving for dead because they're looking at $28 oil or whatever it is and saying, well, clearly this is never going to work. And the reality is, I think virtually everybody in this room can agree that we're probably not sustainably in a $30 oil price environment. And so I think you have a resource base that will eventually grow. And when it does, you'll need ships to move it. And I think what investors can longer term get behind is something where, again, there's a predictable level of demand growth. Like to Herman's point earlier, one of the things that investors like to see is predictability. that increases their confidence in their investment. And longer term, to the extent that you have resource bases that will grow, there's a higher degree of longer term predictability in those categories. And I personally think over a longer investment horizon, the LPG and LNG names have a much longer runway in terms of the upside in the equities relative to most of the other categories, which admittedly everything's cheap right now. So.
Let me just say what these guys all said was completely wrong. No, I'm kidding. But basically, I mean, just thinking about LNG, I mean, I'm not the biggest LNG guy. I don't cover the sector. But it seems like it's still in the young ages, as you guys said. I mean, you can actually see the path to growth. You can see how the shipping, how it's going to develop. It might be longer term. It reminds me sort of the tech sector, where when I used to cover tech, where there's sort of the hype stage, and then everyone's excited, and then it sort of collapses, and everyone says, oh, this is horrible. And then eventually it actually does exactly what everyone thought it would do, just longer than it would take. And I think that's pretty much where we are for the LNG, LPG sector now. That's it.
So moving to dry bulk. So last year at this conference, I had posed a question to the panel that I had $100,000. I was prepared to be risky, and I wanted to double my money in the next 12 to 18 months. The panel basically sent me to dry bulk. Just want to report in, it didn't work out that well.
We didn't say what you were going to do. Did you hair the short, or was it?
No, it was a long, you were telling me. Anyway, dry bulk, is it time you suggesting I double down on this year again, or what do you think? Ben, why don't you take, be nice.
Okay, well, I think something has fundamentally changed in the dry bulk space since last year, and we as analysts probably should have predicted it and unfortunately didn't. But when you look at what moves on dry bulk, 51% of all coal that is moved is imported into China. 54% of all aluminum that is moved is imported into China. 45% of all steel is produced in China. You can't be more levered to China than the dry bulk market is. So what happens when Chinese industrial growth, or GDP, goes from 7% to what I think is probably south of 4%? It's not pretty. And that doesn't even begin to touch the supply side. I think that's the issue. It's a levered China play, and China's just not working. Eventually, you know, we'll get to a more sustainable supply and demand balance. But given how there's a saying that used to go around that when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. Well, that's begun to happen in reverse. So when China sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. They're the 800-pound gorilla. Little moves in what's going on in China make big differences in the dry bulk space. Unfortunately, it's a lot more than a little move. It's a big move, and it's going down, and it's still going down. And you know, unfortunately, I don't have any clarity as to when that stops, which is not especially pleasant. So, yeah.
So Onassis once said that, except that the, it's like the day of the quotes, but he once said that, except that the sea will never rest and learn to sail in the high winds. And I fully agree with Ben that the dry market looks very rough the next couple of years. But again, the way to make money is to buy low and sell high. People, I think, forget to remind themselves of why are things cheap. Right now, we are on a nominal 30-year low on asset prices for a very good reason, as Ben just pointed to. And I think, you know, if you look at dry bulk demand growth since 1975 or 1976, volume of trade has increased by 3.4%. And then you can say, well, the last 15 years, China has been 70-80% of the demand growth in the dry market. So if you then look at the period from 75 to 2001, China became a member of WTO in December 2001. If you look at volume trade up until that, it was still about 2.5 to 2.8%, whether you start in 75 or 76, 75 was a down period. So I think fundamentally, do you believe that there is a future for the dry market? When I ask myself that question, I say, yes, I do believe there is a future for the dry bulk market. When it will turn, I find that very challenging to you know, say it will happen tomorrow or December 2017. But I know that if you find, if you can invest into the dry bulk space and sail the rough seas that we have in the next couple of years, most likely you're not going to do a very bad investment. I think that's one of the reasons why you see a lot of the very intelligent and with a very long track record in, of ship owners investing into the dry bulk market. Should you buy in the dry bulk equities? No way. I mean, that's playing Russian roulette. But yeah, I think you should go and buy yourself a ship. Don't take too much debt on it and be patient.
Thank you.
I would argue don't take any debt if you can afford to buy a ship now. But, you know, if you look at it, as you said, I mean, the guys that are buying, for better or for worse, have deep pockets. So if this lasts 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, they'll be okay. It depends on what you want to do. I mean, now's the time that vessel values are insanely cheap. They could get cheaper. I mean, let's be fair. China's, you know, there's a lot of talk that China coal imports are only about 5 to 7% of the total demand for Chinese coal, let's say. But that could go to zero. I mean, it could. China, it's only about 200 million tons. They could easily, you know, environmental concerns, it could go to zero. So we have to see what's going to happen. I generally agree with Herman. I think we're back in the world where dry bulk grows at about 2 to 3% a year going forward, once China sorts itself out. But there's still a vast oversupply of vessels, and that needs to be fixed. You know, I've heard the guys earlier talking about scrapping and layups, and scrapping's better than layups, but I still argue that there's probably too much scrap steel in the world, and there's going to be more. Scrap prices are falling like crazy, so I don't understand why the scrap yards would expand to take more capacity. I just don't see it. So you're looking at 2 to 3 years at least, if you're talking scrapping, to get back to a more balanced market.
But just a follow-up as well. I think Ben said something very smart earlier on.
Impossible.
But I think it's the question you also have to ask yourself is dry bulk the right place to put your money now? Are you getting a better risk reward in other sectors? Should you be buying a ship? I find it amazing that that ship owners today go and buy a tanker in the second-hand market. When you can buy, for example, DHT, which is effectively pricing in $58 million for a five-year-old Cape, right. 26% lower asset prices. It's fully financed, all the vessels on the water. Why on earth do you go and buy a ship? Everything is taken care of for you. You just have to push the buy button and sit and wait, rather than doing all the paperwork with the ship brokers, and I probably shouldn't say that being from a ship broker firm.
Careful.
But it do puzzles me that there are secondhand transactions when the stocks are so cheap from very healthy companies, and you do also have the liquidity to just sell the shares in one day if you want to, rather than having 15 guys inspect the vessel and so on.
Well, Herman, it's not nearly as cool to be in stock owner as it is to be a ship owner. So I think that has a lot to do with that.
Well, look, guys, this has been an excellent discussion. Thank you very much. We're up against time, but maybe we'll just see if there's a couple quick questions from the audience. This is it. I got a lot of good advice last year. This is your chance.
Maybe the question is, can we have a drink?
Nick, please.
Could I point out I wasn't here last year? I wasn't an analyst last year.